Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
And today on our program, we're looking at brains and bodies and how sometimes brains and bodies can get wildly out of sync. And let me offer one more flavor on this theme, which has to do with something that neuropsychologist Paul Brox calls body schema.
Body schema is the brain's sort of working model of the body.
In order for the brain to keep track of where you are, where everything is, it creates an inner representation of you. Hmm. This is what he thinks. A model, very much in the virtual reality sense, of where it thinks you are in space and where it thinks you aren't.
The point is that although we think there's a very solid distinction between where our bodies end and the world begins, in fact, the brain has to work quite hard to produce this kind of consistency of experience. And clearly it can go wrong.
This brings us to pilots.
Okay. My name is Dan Foljam. I spent 32 years in the Air Force, 25 of that in active flying. And this incident occurred in July of 1952 at Luke Air Force Base in Arizona.
Our story begins on a normal training day. It was really hot.
In the cockpit, flying down at low level, below 3,000 feet, it was over 100 degrees.
And Colonel Dan Foljam was on his fifth run, flying in formation, doing a training maneuver he'd done a million times before. But this time, something happened. He pulled the plane up hard, rolled out.
And the next thing I knew, I was seemed to be sitting up on the back of the airplane, looking down into the cockpit.
Suddenly, he was outside the plane, not inside.
I could see what was going on. I could see the ground. I could see another airplane. And
when he looked in the cockpit, where he was supposed to be, he could see a pilot.
I was watching myself, not knowing it was me. What's going on here? I'm just going to watch this for a little while.
So he just sat there, on the wing of his own plane, watching himself fly the plane.
And then just all of a sudden, the curtain snaps up and you realize, no, it's not a dream. Actually, that's me in the cockpit and I'm flying the airplane again. But we begin to realize at Luke that in the 8 weeks of training period that I was there, we lost 9 pilots.
They died?
Yeah.
Wow.
And most of them for running into the ground or running into each other in the air and that sort of thing. And that's an awful lot of pilots to lose just in training.
Okay, fast forward many years. Army engineers are studying this problem and they figured out some stuff about it, but not much. And then along comes this guy.
I'm Jim Winery.
Jim Winery is his name.
I'm at the Federal Aviation Administration Air Medical Research Program.
And he had a radical notion. If we're going to really understand this, I mean really get to the bottom of this, we have to induce this experience on purpose.
Make them go blank? Make them go...
Yeah, create the conditions that exist in a fighter jet on the ground in a controlled environment so they can study this. Mm-hmm. His idea was let's put pilots in a centrifuge.
This big centrifuge.
Like one of these things that the astronauts use. It's got a 50-foot arm that spins round and round.
Round and around. And on the end of that 50-foot arm,
there's a cockpit.
A cockpit.
A pretend cockpit.
Mocked up to be exactly like what a fighter aircraft might be like, with all the controls, the screens, the throttle.
That's where the pilot sits and gets spun around real fast.
I see.
So Winery put out a call for volunteers.
I'm Tim Sestak.
Commander Sestak.
I met Dr. Winery.
He was one of the ones that
got involved in his research.
Heroically volunteered to fly the centrifuge and to deliberately knock himself out.
Scared? Pilots don't do scared.
3, 2, 1, pressure.
This is a recording from the experiment.
The task was to chase this little airplane. So I'd sit there and you'd follow it, and first couple maneuvers would be, you know, 3 G's.
G-forces is the...
Well, it's like when you're on a roller coaster.
5 G's.
That force that pins you back in your seat?
Yeah, yeah.
7 G's.
Except really on a roller coaster, you're only ever going to experience about 2 G's.
And then 9 G's.
Nothing like these guys.
The high G-forces hurt. The skin on your face sags, your eyelids sag so low that you can't see out from under them, and you wind up tilting your head back to look out from under your own eyelids that are sagging down in front of your face.
Meanwhile, you're tensing all your leg muscles and your abdominal muscles and your arm muscles as hard as you can.
You learn to use your body to fight it, and what you do is you tense every muscle from your toes to your calves and thighs.
Push it out. Push it all the way up. All the way up. Okay.
And you take a breath.
Get the breath.
And you start to say the word hook. And you hold it for 3 seconds, and then you finish it off by finishing the K of the hook.
So these pilots, they sound like they're wrestling or fighting or something. Hook! And they're grunting and groaning and hook! Making all these hook noises.
It's like that.
The most G I've ever pulled was 12.4 Gs.
Just to give you a sense of what that might feel like, for a pilot like Tim Sestak, who weighs about 200 pounds, once he makes a 12.4 G turn, his body goes from 200 pounds to almost 2,500 pounds. So that's like over the weight of a car.
Because of the pressure pushing down on it.
Yeah, exactly. More crucially, says Winery, those G-forces pull blood.
The blood.
Violently from the brain.
Is pushed from the head down toward the feet, and it pools in the abdomen and the lower extremities. And when it pools down there, it can't get back up to the brain.
And that's when the problems start.
Well, this doesn't sound very good.
No. Dr. Winery documented a particular sequence that happens when blood is pulled from the brain.
The first thing you lose is vision.
Usually the first thing to go are your eyes.
And you have what's called gray out.
Gray out.
Or loss of peripheral vision.
And you start getting tunnel vision. And
then you go through blackout where you can see nothing.
You lose your sight.
And then if you take the acceleration forces a little higher, you'll lose consciousness.
When I woke up, I remember just sitting there, and I'm in this little white space. I actually had no idea who I was, who am I, where I was, or what I was doing. Why am I doing this? So I'm sitting in this little white ball, and I'm looking around, and what is this all about? I hear this beeping. There's this white light beeping. And then at that moment, I realize that I'm in a little room and that I'm supposed to do something, and that one of the things I'm supposed to do is press that button. So I press the button. And at that moment, I realize, holy mackerel, I'm a pilot, I'm in an airplane, and I'm not flying it. And I grab the controls, and then just in a giant rush. I'm Tim Sestak. Holy mackerel, I'm Tim Sestak. I'm Tim Sestak, I'm a pilot, I'm flying in the centrifuge. All came back to me at once, and I was okay.
Commander Sestak, Dr. Bennett, how you feeling?
Again, like I've been gone a long time.
Over the course of 15 years, Winery tested about 500 pilots in the centrifuge. He recorded their experiences, measured everything he could think of, and he found a few things. First, that the average blackout lasted somewhere between 12 and 24 seconds.
24 seconds?
Yeah. And while blacked out, this is the interesting thing, pilots experienced these strange little visions.
Visions?
I'll give you an example of the individual that lost consciousness, had convulsive movements where he was moving his arms forward and back for about 2 or 3 seconds. When he came to, we asked him what had happened. He said, yeah, it was a nice warm day, and I was out at the lake fishing. All of a sudden, I could feel like I had about a 5-pound bass on my line, and he was tugging, and each time he tugged, I would pull back. And then all of a sudden, I was back in the centrifuge. I don't know what happened.
These little dreamlets. Winery thinks this is the brain confused. It's cut off.
Meaning?
Think of it from the brain's perspective. It's lost the body, and yet the body is convulsing, trying to get blood back up to the brain. The brain has no idea why it's convulsing. It just sees arms flailing about, and it thinks, well, my arms are jerking back and forth. I must be bass fishing.
The things that are happening around you frequently get incorporated into those short dreamlets.
Here's one of his own. Turns out he has tested himself in the centrifuge many times.
The little dreamlet that I had, I was going down the aisle of a grocery store, floating, if you will. I don't know that I was on a magic carpet, but I sure wasn't having to walk. And I was just really motivated to try to pick up some ice cream as I was going down the aisle. And I was moving down through there, and I could see the freezer. I knew the ice cream was over there, and I just could not move my hand over to get it. The next thing I realized was I was trying to turn off the buzzer in the centrifuge with my hand, and I could hear it. I could not move it, and then just momentarily, I got the ability to have motor control return, and I could turn it off.
Shit, I don't know where I am. Honest to God, I don't know where the hell I am. I thought I was at the grocery store. By the way, the other thing is I couldn't control my arm to get the sound off either.
That's interesting.
This recording you're listening to is from a day when Dr. Winery blacked out 5 times in a row.
I don't remember anything on that one.
Okay.
And after that 5th run, which you're about to hear, something weird happened.
Let you take a break just a few seconds, catch your breath.
I don't know about that one. I don't remember starting that one.
Last ride coming up.
God, I don't
know. If you can take one more.
I'm hesitating because I'm not ready yet.
Sir?
I say I'm hesitating because I'm not quite ready yet.
Okay, just let me know whenever you get ready. Go ahead and relax. Let your blood flow through your brain a little bit.
Okay, I'm ready for the last one, I guess.
Okay, final checklist. Data station. Data station is ready. Operator? Operator is ready. Medical? Medical is ready. Final ready, please. Okay, sir, final ready has been activated. Are you ready?
God, I guess. I'm going up this time, right?
Yes, sir.
I'm
going to
remember going up on this one.
Yes, sir. 3, 2, 1, pressure.
I think that was enough.
At the end of that last run, Dr. Winery got off the centrifuge, woozy, and stumbled down the hall.
I was really confused when I got off the centrifuge, and I was walking down the hall back to my laboratory, and all of a sudden I began to realize that I was above and behind myself, and I could see somebody who was myself walking down the hall. And I said, oh, man, that's unusual.
Pilots are generally not new age kind of guys, but at least 40 of them in Winery's study did report what he just described, having an out-of-body experience. Weirder still, an even smaller sub-subgroup reported seeing the classic tunnel with white light type thing. All Dr. Winery can say is that last sub-subgroup, they were the ones who were out the longest. They had the most intense blackouts. He's not ready to draw any conclusions. But he does suspect that the dreamlets, the visions of seeing yourself from above, even the tunnel and white lights, it's all part of the same situation. The brain is just confused at having lost the body. Anne Hepperman and Kara Oler produced that piece for us. Thank you to them. And thanks also to our pilots, Dan Foljam, Tim Sestak, and of course, Jim Winley.
Wow.
That's all the time we have. For more information on anything you heard this hour, visit our website, radiolab.org. And while you are there, send us an email. Our email address, you know it.
No.
Come on.
I've never really learned it. Radiolab.org or something like that?
No, that's our website address. Oh. If you would like to email us, we do like to get email. The address is radiolab@wnyc.org. I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Crowley.
Thanks for listening.
Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad and Ellen Horn, with help from Sarah Pellegrini, Joan Allaire, Sally Herships, Melissa Keevil, Lulu Miller, Amber Seeley, and Brett Beyer. Special thanks to Arwen Curry, Tamar Lewin, Nick Capodocci, Ann Hepperman, Kara Oler, and Keith Scott. Production management by Dean Capello and Michael Elsesor. And a very special thanks to me. I'm Tim Sestak, fully conscious and happy to be speaking to you from this side of the Great Divide. Radiolab is produced by New York Public Radio, WNYC, and distributed by NPR. Okay, thanks. Bye.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.